From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
A two-week-long celebration of business as usual and blah, blah, blah. It should be obvious that we cannot solve a crisis with the same methods that got us into it in the first place.
While it's heartening to have the current administration re-engage the U.S. in global cooperation on the climate crisis, precious time was lost in the past 4 years. And most experts say we are still doing far too little. A diverse coalition of religious groups called Green Faith has been watching closely. And we'll get the perspectives of Executive Director, the Reverend Fletcher Harper, direct from COP26 in Glasgow, Scotland.
We will never give up our individual conscience and religious freedom or our God-given right to choose.
You really have to squint hard to see the constitutional acceptability of Texas' draconian anti-abortion law. But conservative courts designed to squint just like that have managed to do so. Nobody's happier than the contingent that authored these regulations, fundamentally based on a narrow reading of, they say, Christian doctrine. But on the front lines of keeping women who need abortion services safe and alive is a network of activists, many of whom are involved because of their faith, not in spite of their faith. Excellent coverage in the Christian Science Monitor appears under the byline of Henry Gass, who will be joining us later in the hour.
The way they're assembling their faith is really centering around some key social issues and values that a lot of people would say are good values.
Springtide Research Institute focuses on the sociology of young people 13 through 25. This week, the Institute released the State of Religion and Young People 2021, a comprehensive report that Institute Executive Director Josh Packard presented in his Religion Dispatches article headlined, Gen Z is turning away from religion in order to live out their values, and he'll be here with the details. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it. You can do it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. Now, if you've made a donation this week, thank you so much. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now to our first guest. Reverend Fletcher Harper is the executive director of Green Faith, a national interfaith environmental coalition which has long been effective in gathering diverse people of goodwill around the moral mandate to care for our world and to address the high-stakes challenge of the climate crisis. With the Conference of Parties 26 and to wrap up in Glasgow, I wanted to get a briefing on what's happened and what hasn't, at least so far. We have Fletcher with us. He is actually in Glasgow.
Well, that's great. Great to be with you and your listeners. And I'm here in the negotiations area at the COP venue, actually in the Scottish Food Court of all places. So here we go.
What was Green Faith and its partners hoping to see happen in the course of the COP26 summit?
What we want to see is we want to see firm commitments by governments and by financial institutions to stop projects that are destroying the climate and the planet. And that means new oil and gas, coal, oil and gas projects. It means further deforestation, because those are the massive drivers of the climate crisis. And they've just simply got to stop. And we need to have those commitments from governments. And we also need those commitments from asset managers and banks, because together they are the forces that are driving this crisis. So we came in wanting to see that. And I'm very, very sad to say that that has not materialized at a meaningful level. We see some action around the margins. We see a last minute statement issued late last night by the US and China, which essentially said they would resume joint efforts to move climate progress forward, but it did not break any new ground. And so we're left with this profound sense of concern and frustration that the most powerful institutions on the planet, governmental and financial and corporate, are simply not delivering at the level that all of our faiths absolutely require.
There are concrete actions Green Faith is inviting all people to take while the conference is taking place. So let's get to that. What are the demands for climate justice you're inviting folks to sign on to?
So there's a new initiative that we're very proud to be part of called the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. It's framed in some ways after the model of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, making the legitimate point that fossil fuels, while they've done much good in the past, are now a deadly threat to the future of life on the planet. And so what that treaty calls on is governments to negotiate and ratify a binding treaty that will stop the development of new fossil fuels, develop a plan for a managed decline in their use, and provide resources for a just and equitable transition to a clean energy future. We are behind this, which it's a new concept being developed by civil society organizations of various kinds. Youth climate groups are getting behind it. They had a compelling press conference today. We're behind this because this is the kind of paradigm shift that's absolutely needed. And we were excited today to see that a dozen countries signed on to a statement saying that they would start to work towards a world beyond coal and oil and gas. We need those kinds of commitments. And this civil society effort is something that we're making a push on. So that's one piece. And people can sign on to that by going to greenfaith.org/treaty. Greenfaith.org/treaty, and they can sign on there. And a second initiative that we think is important is the Climate Vulnerable Forum, which is a coalition of 55 countries around the world, the most vulnerable to climate change, small Pacific Island states, countries like Bangladesh that are both poor and coastal, so enormously vulnerable to sea level rise, are calling on wealthy governments to make good on their previous but yet unfulfilled commitment of $100 billion a year in climate, so in financial support to these vulnerable nations, and calling on governments to be required under the Paris Agreement to increase their commitments every single year, not just every 5 years, but every year. It's the kind of response that makes sense when you're dealing with the emergency that we are, and we're very glad to support that.
The Pope's engagement with the climate crisis on moral grounds has made headlines on a regular basis. Has that been helpful in marshaling faith-oriented people to this cause? And are there other denominational leaders that are making this a priority?
So we see and it's a great credit to the religious and interfaith groups here in Scotland. We've seen a tremendous upsurge of religious engagement around the COP here in Scotland, which has been very important. What the Pope has done, which is as and more important, is to get very specific about the types of things that he is calling on governments to do. He's calling on governments to phase out fossil fuels. He's calling on investors to get out of coal, oil, and gas investments. So there's a specificity and frankly, a moral political specificity to what he's calling for that represents the next level of leadership that we need more religious leaders to move towards. The Dalai Lama is a signatory or has endorsed the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, the agreement I mentioned, which calls for an end to new fossil fuels, a managed decline to the industry, and a just transition. So what we think is important is seeing senior religious leaders use their moral influence to make specific demands. It's no longer enough to say God wants us to care for creation. What we need is people to say God wants us to care for creation and people, and therefore we need an end to the fossil fuel era, an end to finance for dirty energy, a commitment to universal clean energy access, and some specific things to help build cultural, moral, political space so that governments then can follow.
Hmm. Fletcher, I don't have to tell you there are powerful conservative forces in our country, a lot of political evangelicals mostly visible, who have resisted addressing the climate crisis for decades now with rationalizations they say are based in Scripture. Are we finally seeing the influence of this dangerous distraction fading away?
It's not adequately faded yet. Within a U.S. cultural, moral, political context, the alliance between many white evangelicals, not all. I mean, you see fantastic groups like Young Evangelicals for Climate Action and others who are doing really good work rallying support within the white evangelical community for climate action. But still too often, you will either see this issue treated dismissively or not prioritized or outright opposed by largely white conservative Christian groups in the United States. You see that by Pentecostal and fundamentalist Christians in Brazil. You see it by very hardline Islamic interests in the Gulf states. You see it to some degree by Hindu nationalist groups in India and so on. You see it by conservative Christian political cultural formations in France, in Eastern Europe. So this phenomenon of religion being used to further and support the interests of extractivist industries that are absolutely devastatingly deadly for people and planet. I think we need to continue to call the moral question, how can people of faith take a position in support of industries, which, like I say, nobody's debating that they've contributed to progress in the past, and we can be grateful for that. But the time is long past for denial about the need for change. Yeah. And religious leaders, I think if they're not willing to, I think you really, it's a look in the moment, in the mirror, sort of, talk to God honestly moment. Mm-hmm. The impacts of climate change, Welton, are not abstract. It is people losing their homes because of droughts and floods and fires. It is small farmers being forced to become refugees because they can no longer survive where their families have farmed for generations and generations. These are unholy and sinful impacts that are largely the responsibility of us in the wealthy countries of the world. And our God calls us to do better.
Can I just say amen to that? You said it so well. We're speaking on Thursday, so COP26 is not quite over. But from what you've seen and heard, What are the most important takeaways for your members and for our audience? And what did you find encouraging and what did you find disappointing?
We knew going into this COP, because by the time the COP arrives, a large majority of government positions are already set in place. So we knew going in that this COP was going to represent a substantial disappointment. There has been some movement in the area of finance with a number of financial institutions pledging without a deep level of specificity, pledging that they'll start to decarbonize their portfolios. So that's a positive thing. We've seen a number of overseas international development banks and agencies say that they will stop financing and funding new fossil fuel projects and that they will support investments in clean energy. So that's, you know, those are positive steps, but those of us who've been in this game for a while know that the proof of the pudding is in the eating. It's one thing to come and say something at COP. It's an entirely different thing to go home and do it. So I think the most important thing that can come out of this COP is a deepened and renewed sense of moral passion on behalf of grassroots people of diverse faiths to stand up, to call for what is right, to be willing to go into the streets peacefully, to make their voices heard in the public square, to make their ways into the voting booths en masse. You know, this will change based on cultural momentum shifting on these issues. And from that regard, religious people have a huge and historic role to play. And we, you know, we want to, you know, every ounce of energy we've got is going to be going into lifting up those grassroots voices, because that in the end is how we get to the place we need to go.
How does the people around you who are in other lands, how do they really see the United States and our commitment or maybe non-commitment on this issue?
They continue to have hopes, and they also have some level of cynicism. For example, the United States and other countries pledged $100 billion a year that was supposed to start last year in climate finance support for the most vulnerable countries of the world. That pledge was initially made 8 years ago. And when countries around the world that are suffering see the United States and other wealthy countries pour trillions of dollars into COVID relief, and they can't spare a portion, a tiny portion of that for making good on their international climate loss and damage commitments, it hurts, and it really undermines our credibility. I think that it is, you know, internationally, you know, there is hope that the U.S. will provide leadership. I think there's a realism now. We've been through the spin cycle enough, going from George W. Bush, then to President Obama, then to President Trump, and now to President Biden. There is a sense that the United States is not the most reliable of partners in the long term in terms of its government's stance. And again, that's something that we have to change in the U.S., and faith communities have a really important role of shifting cultural momentum around this. I think that, you know, I've said this before on your show, Welton, politicians follow where there is a cultural space for them to go.
Yeah.
And in our view, they are not being courageous enough on climate. We need to make it impossible for them not to act morally and with urgency on this. That's the only thing that I can say.
Fletcher, what other initiatives, what kinds of initiatives are planned to keep the focus on the climate crisis once this conference is over?
Early in the first quarter of 2022, Green Faith is going to be launching two initiatives. One is we're going to be calling on, we're going to be gathering a very diverse range of religious institutions and people from around the world, all of whom have, in one way or another, bank accounts, some of whom may have investment accounts. And we are going to be training and equipping and inviting them to go and bug the heck out of their bankers and asset managers to tell them, you cut out this lending and this financing for new fossil fuel projects. You invest in climate solutions. You cannot continue to do business as usual. So that's one piece, is going to be really to lean in on financial institutions, on asset managers and banks. You know, companies like BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, which likes to see itself as a green leader, but which is one of the world's biggest investors in oil and gas and deforestation. Mm-hmm. You cannot say that you're a green leader and continue to fund and finance that stuff. You cannot do it unless you're doing sort of 1984 George Orwell language where up is down. So that's one piece. Another thing that we're going to be doing, we're going to be continuing to pressure governments all over the world to cut out these new oil and gas projects, these new pipelines. In the U.S., we're going to be relentless in terms of standing, following the lead of indigenous groups and calling on the Biden administration to cut out the new fossil fuel infrastructure projects, which the administration can do in many cases with the stroke of a pen. They are not powerless. And so those are some things. We're also going to be calling on wealthy communities, wealthy households around the world to adopt climate-friendly lifestyles. We know that we need systemic change. We also know that when individuals stand up and lead, particularly those of us in high-consuming countries, and when we talk about that, that's part of how you build this cultural shift. That's the precursor to the political change that we need. So those are some things that we're going to be working on. And folks can find out more at our website at greenfaith.org if they'd like.
The Reverend Fletcher Harper is an Episcopal priest and the executive director of Green Faith, a national interfaith environmental coalition. The ongoing growth of this network is one hopeful sign in an otherwise alarming escalation of climate crisis evidence. Fletcher, thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for the chance to be together. It's always good to hear you. And now here we are on Zoom. Well, good to see you too.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, a frontline look at faith-motivated activists for reproductive rights in Texas. And later, new research on young people leaving organized religion. The reasons may surprise you. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. The Christian Science Monitor headline was unsurprising for those of us who understand religious values in this country are as diverse as they are sincerely held. I had to stand up and say no. Pro-choice Christians battle Texas law. But for many Americans, media coverage and political claims in recent years misrepresent Christianity as marching in lockstep behind theocratic absolutists on abortion and women's health issues. That's why it's so important to highlight stories such as this one, and I am happy that it brings correspondent Henry Gass to State of Belief Radio. Henry, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Good to be here.
How has SB 8 changed the lives of Texas women, including Christians?
Well, so far, it's been just over 2 months since it went into effect. There was a slight pause for a couple of days in October, sort of while it was moving through the courts. But in sum, the effects that have been documented so far is sort of the number of abortions performed in September, the first month it was in effect, was 50% lower than the September before. And there have been sort of reports of large increases in the number of women from Texas accessing abortion in sort of neighboring states like Oklahoma and New Mexico. Mm-hmm. It's unclear statistically exactly what the effect has been, but it's safe to say that abortions have declined significantly.
You write about how this draconian law has forced some Texans to take a stand for the first time. I wish you would talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, it is the views on this issue in the faith communities is very diverse. So it's first you have to note that this is some people in the faith community to which this applies to, but for some, it's been sort of a tipping point. I guess you could say they sort of been unclear how they felt exactly on abortion and reproductive rights, but with SB8 and in particular with the sort of the so-called bounty provision within the law, that's pushed them to the point where that just feels wrong to them and doesn't sort of align with their beliefs and morals and feelings about the issue, but also about sort of society more generally, and it doesn't sort of correspond with their faith and how they think people should be treating each other.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about one or two of the people of faith that you spoke to about their activism?
Sure. So for this story, I traveled to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and spoke with some groups there who have been helping women from Texas who've travel out of state and receive abortions sort of in Albuquerque and elsewhere in New Mexico. And I spoke with one woman there who is a volunteer and sort of hadn't been, and this is partly sort of COVID related, is hadn't been sort of as active with the group before, but after SB 8 went into effect, she became more, wanted to become more involved with the group and wanted to help women in Texas find reproductive health care in New Mexico. And another woman was a pastor in Texas who told me she'd been conflicted, I suppose, on reproductive rights for a very long time. She'd sort of slowly been softening to it, I suppose, and changing her views slightly. But with SB8, it sort of was a tipping point for her. It was so harsh and so inconsistent with her beliefs that it sort of clarified her feelings slightly. She did tell me she is still pondering reproductive rights and how they align with her religious beliefs, but it's definitely been for her a significant tipping point.
Yeah. Henry, are there enough folks on the ground trying to help that they are making a real difference, or are most crisis pregnancies going undressed from what you're seeing?
That is very difficult to know because there isn't any data on the women who are now choosing to carry their pregnancies to term. Like, that's sort of hard to get a sense of. What a lot of people I've spoken with about this can believe and I think is reasonable to infer is that most Texas women probably can't get the time and afford to leave the state to get a medical procedure. Like, every abortion clinic in the state is complying with the law and, you know, aren't providing abortions for people who have been pregnant for longer than the 6 weeks is required by the law. But for a lot of women, they can't afford the travel expenses, or they can't get the time away from work or their families to make that trip. Many of the states, the border Texas, also have pretty strict abortion laws in place and don't have many clinics in their states. So the number of Texas women going out of state to receive abortions has gone up significantly, but the number who aren't able to do that is probably quite a bit higher.
There's been such confusion as courts have made conflicting rulings on SB 8. Clinics have had to open and then close on a moment's notice. What is the effect of that on women who are in the midst of making such a difficult decision?
I think confusion is the presiding effect, I would say. That, I mean, number one, most women don't know if they're pregnant or not 6 weeks after conception. That's sort of the first factor that is causing some confusion. But women also don't know if they're even allowed to go to a clinic to find out if they're pregnant or not, because they're afraid that might be illegal. Is it something else I've heard? There's a lot of confusion and a good amount of fear as well.
On this show, State of Belief, we highlight the work of Texas Freedom Network and Just Texas on a regular basis. Do you see broader coalitions of faith-inspired activism forming in Texas?
I'm not sure about that myself. I'm familiar with those groups and know that the work they've been doing for some time now. And from other folks I've spoken to, it does sound like some people are more sort of more active and more engaged with this than they were before SB 8. But I'm not sure how significant that is myself.
Do you see activist networks now digging in for the long term, or is the fundamental hope that we will see this go away?
I would say activists are digging in. I would say they're also preparing for the worst, because there's SB 8, which has an unclear future, I'd say, is the most confident statement we can make at this point. But then there's also the Supreme Court is hearing a case next month that could lead to the right to abortion being overturned nationwide. Yeah. And so they're also thinking about that possibility. SB 8 itself is, as I said, sort of unclear what its future will be.
Henry, I'd like you to talk about what else is central to this awful situation in Texas that those of us who aren't on the ground there may not even be aware of. What do all Americans need to know that you as a working journalist knows?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I suppose based on my reporting for this story, what I think is important to know is that views on this are very diverse and they are fluid as well. We hear often from the camps who sort of have very firm and unbending views on this, but there are a lot of Americans, the majority of Americans, I think it's safe to say, who aren't really firmly in one camp or another and are sort of pondering it like the pastor I spoke with in Texas sort of all the time. And it's difficult. And I think it's important to keep in mind that this is something that lots of people in the country are pondering. And there are sort of tipping points like this sometimes. But I think it's important and worthwhile to keep in mind the idea that lots of people have sort of mixed feelings on it, different feelings and feelings that change. So I'd say that's one of the important things to take away at this moment.
Henry Gass is correspondent at the Christian Science Monitor. His recent article is headlined, "I Had to Stand Up and Say No, Pro-Choice Christians Battle Texas Law," and we will link to that from stateofbelief.com. Henry, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Josh Packard is executive director of Springtide Research Institute, the only sociological research institute in the U.S. solely dedicated to young people, 13 through 25. This week, the Institute released some eye-opening findings from its report, The State of Religion and Young People 2021, and I am pleased to have Dr. Packard with us on State of Belief Radio. Josh, thank you for making the time to be with us again.
Happy to be here. I like being on. It's great.
You highlight some key findings in a Religion Dispatches article provocatively headlined, Gen Z is turning away from religion in order to live out their values. Now, that is a very positive approach to a subject that many people see as discouraging.
So when we do this, you know, every year we come out in the fall with the State of Religion and Young People. I mean, it's obviously has a different focus every fall, but the idea is to wrap up everything that we've been learning about young people that year. And every year we collect about 10,000 nationally representative surveys from 13 to 25 year olds, and we do, you know, hundreds of interviews. And one of the things that came through this year, through the pandemic, was, you know, that young people are obviously dealing with a very uncertain world. That has been sort of the hallmark. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, it's the hallmark of youth generally is uncertainty and change and all of that, but it has been heightened over this past year of COVID all kinds of other issues that have been brought up. Mm-hmm. What has been interesting to see is that while young people's faith hasn't been eroded, you know, I mean, 75% or so of young people tell us that they're spiritual or religious, and most young people tell us that their faith remains stable through the pandemic. In fact, that breaks down to about 50% said it's the same, about 25% said it's gone down, about 25% said it's gone up, actually. So their traditional markers of faith and belief are pretty well intact. But under the surface, what we're seeing is this, the way they're assembling their faith is really centering around some key social issues and some you know, values that a lot of people would say are good values that are really not sort of, you know, they're not part and parcel. In fact, they're driving the bus when it comes to belief and how, you know, how they engage with religious systems.
Yeah. So what are the ways the members of this demographic aged 13 through 25 are describing their values and the ways organized religion is seen as an obstacle?
Yes. The first thing to understand about this generation is that, you know, and this is really important to keep front of mind, is it is the most diverse generation that has ever existed anywhere in the history of the world, period. And you know, generations are always more diverse than we typically give them credit for. But this group of young people, not only are they the most diverse, but what that means is that when you start expanding out their access through digital means, you know, on social media and the internet generally, they not only are diverse demographically, but they're diverse experientially. And that's different because our country is still relatively segregated. I mean, the famous quote from Martin Luther King that Sunday mornings are the most segregated hour, that's largely because residentially, you know, we tend to be pretty segregated for a bunch of reasons we don't need to get into, you know, right here. But online, it's not so segregated. Not if you don't want it to be. You know, you're no longer confined just to the people who live in your neighborhood and go to your school. Mm-hmm. And what that means for this generation then is that diversity, equity, and inclusion become these paramount values for young people. I mean, absolutely paramount. We did the study a couple of years ago, actually, and like over half of them said that they wouldn't even consider joining or working for an organization that didn't have diversity, equity, and inclusion among its top values. Mm-hmm. And we see the same thing when it comes to these religious groups. So when we look at the values and the issues driving Gen Z, you know, it's things like gender equity, LGBTQ+ rights, Black Lives Matter, gun reform. And for reasons we can get into, they don't always see religious groups as caring about those things or sharing those values in the same way that they care about those issues and have those values. And so there's a real disconnect there in their heads between, you know, what they care about and what they see religious communities caring about.
Hmm. Have you looked into the family dynamics that develop when young people turn away from what in many cases are core beliefs and group activities for families where the parents actively practice their religion?
We haven't looked at that group specifically, but here's what's still true. Parents or guardians or whoever's in the household with young people, that they are, have always been, and remain the single most influential group in the faith lives of young people. Now, I think it's really, you know, it's important to note here, you mentioned turning away, and I say we haven't looked at that group specifically, but look, I get asked by religious leaders a lot, you know, how can we get these young people back into church? And the answer to that is, you know, that would have been a really great question to ask in, say, 2003. But these young people haven't left church. These young people were never in church. Yeah. They, you know, they're being raised by a generation of parents who left church, or mosque or synagogue or whatever. And so what we've got is about 40% of young people saying that 13 to 25 year olds, about 40% of them saying that they have no religious affiliation. They don't identify as Christian or Jewish or, you know, Muslim or et cetera. Well, that's not so different than the trend that's been in place for a while. I mean, the generation just past them, you know, says that they have no affiliation at about 37%. So, you know, this is just a continuation of a trend. And it's in some ways, I think that that's really good news if you're a religious leader. They're not rejecting you in the sense that, like, they didn't go and have this bad experience and then, like, leave because they hate you. In fact, I was having this conversation with a Catholic audience this summer, and they were asking about, like, what do young people think about, you know, offering Joe Biden communion? And I was like, they nothing that conversation. They're not for it or against it. They nothing it. Like, it doesn't even resonate with them at all. And I think actually that's where a lot of this disconnect between, you know, how young people feel like they have these values, but they don't see those values showing up in religious communities. Yeah. Well, in large part, I think a lot of that is because they don't always know religious communities. And so they're making big assumptions about them, which is, by the way, what happens anytime. I mean, that's what in-group people do for out-group people. This is where stereotypes are born generally. Well, we've got a generation now where, by and large, for like religious leaders, religious communities, faith communities, those are out groups for these young people. Mm-hmm. And so then we get a bunch of, you know, some accurate, but maybe some overblown ideas about them that come from it.
When you look at this demographic, how does that vary across different faith traditions, or does it?
Well, we certainly see much more, I mean, in terms of magnitude, we see much more erosion among people who would have normally fallen into the sort of Christian bucket. Mm-hmm. That's been, you know, we're not the only ones to show that. Pew and others have been showing that. But in part, that's because, you know, that's the largest group by far of religious identifying people in this country. Other groups, Jewish, Muslims, et cetera, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, et cetera, make up, I mean, we're talking like low single digits in terms of the percentage of the population. Sure. So they're not, I mean, some of them are experiencing the same erosion. And certainly there's concern there, especially among Muslim and Jewish populations. Buddhists have in some cases seen some slight uptick. But certainly the one that sort of like reaches the place where religious leaders start getting really, really concerned is in the Christian group.
Do you have a sense of how many of your respondents are, let's say, in the closet about their disaffection with religion, meaning that they must act out rituals of faith but feel no connection with them?
Fascinating. Yeah. So I'm going to get, I mean, we have not asked that question directly, but we've got a bunch of data around that issue. And so it's somewhere, I would say, about a quarter would be my guess. So last year, in the State of Religion and Young People, we asked these questions about affiliation and unaffiliation. And turns out those categories are far more complicated under the surface than you would have guessed. So just because you check the box that says, yes, I'm like Christian Catholic, for example, I think we used to be able to make a whole set of assumptions that came with that maybe aren't such good assumptions. So like 52% or so, 50% of young people who are affiliated say that they have little to no trust in organized religion, right? And like a surprisingly high number of unaffiliated young people say that they pray on a pretty regular basis, that they, you know, go to worship services, you know, several times a year or even a monthly. Yeah. So there's just a tremendous amount of diversity within those categories, so much so, in fact, that I think that those categories are not very good markers that we should be using to make assumptions about. And more than anything, what I think it speaks to is this. We're doing an interview, and this young person told me, she's like, I like my youth director, but I don't like youth directors. You know what I mean? And I think that's a large part of the story that we're both last year and this year that we're seeing in the State of Religion reports, which is the individual relationships drive faith development for young people. And the institutional sort of, you know, programmatic efforts just do not resonate with this generation in the way that they have with previous generations.
In the data this year, what was the most surprising for you in the results?
Well, so we asked young people right at the beginning of the pandemic, in late March, early April of 2020, you know, who, if anybody, has reached out just to check on you? And 1% or so said that a faith leader had reached out to them. Mm-hmm. So then we followed up again, and and asked the same questions again in February, March of 2021. So 1 year into the pandemic, and that number had only risen to 10%. So in the most tumultuous year that any of us have probably ever experienced, certainly collectively, and in the most tumultuous year of these young people's lives, you know, they really needed people to come along and help them make sense out of what was happening. But it just wasn't the people most well positioned to do that simply weren't accessible to young people. Now, you can read that as an individual failure and say like, oh, well, priests and pastors and rabbis and youth ministers and like they should do better. I'm not really sure that's the right way to read that data. To me, that speaks not to individual failing, but to just a significant mismatch between what our organizations and institutions and religion are set up to do and what young people need them to do. Mm. We haven't met a single, I give lots of talks. I meet a lot of youth pastors, you know, do a lot of trainings. I have never met a youth pastor who I thought wasn't trying hard enough or like a priest who didn't care enough. I mean, those are just, it's just not the issue. I think the issue is that we just, you know, we don't like how, you know, how does a church systematically reach out to every young person in their community repeatedly over the course of a pandemic? Why? We just don't, we have lots of good innovations on a program level. I don't know that we've done a really great job yet of figuring out how to innovate and scale up on a relational level like that.
Josh, what else do you think is really important for people to understand about this report?
Well, I think it's critical to understand how interested young people are in the conversation around faith and religion and what are essentially religious questions. You know, what's going to happen when I die? What should I do with my life? How should I live? They are looking for and going to get answers in some way, shape, or form. I think the only real question is whether you're going to be the one that's next to them when they're asking the question or if they're going to go someplace else. Yeah. But I think for a while we've been assuming that because they don't show up on Sunday mornings or on Wednesday nights or what have you, that they're not interested. And our data show pretty conclusively that that's not the case. They are very interested. And our goal is to be in that, you know, should be to stay in that conversation with them for as long as possible.
If these patterns hold, what will religion in America look like 20 years from now?
Well, I think it's clear that the religion in America is going to look dramatically different in 20 years than it does now. And the real question is how. Is it going to look like a shell of what it is currently, or is it going to be renewed and revitalized? And I've got a lot of hope. I mean, this generation, Gen Z, every marker that we've got here indicates that they're not the deconstructionists that I think a lot of maybe previous generations were. They're very interested in building new things to meet their needs around these values. And I'm really heartened by the responses of the religious leaders that I talk to who genuinely care and want to be there with them and help them build those new structures. So that's not to say that is inevitable, but maybe color me an optimist. I'm a believer in the human spirit.
I'll take that any day. Dr. Josh Packard is Executive Director of Spring Tide Research Institute, the only sociological research institute in the U.S. solely dedicated to young people, 13 through 25. Their findings offer unique insights into what America will look like in just a few years because demography is destiny. Josh writes about the findings of the new report, The State of Religion and Young People 2021, in his Religion Dispatches article. Gen Z is turning away from religion in order to live out their values, And we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Thanks for taking time to be back with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man, you see.